I must begin with a disclaimer, much as Mac Owens did. The reason I'm using my moniker as the chairman of the Committee for Western Civilization is that I really work at the Defense Department, and I wouldn't want anything I'm about to say here be construed as the expression of the view of the United States government, even though it's correct. Now, the Committee for Western Civilization may sound to you a somewhat intimidating title, but we are dedicated to Viennese waltzing. You may have heard an aspersion earlier today on Metternich's reputation. But the Committee on Western Civilization holds that from the Congress of Vienna to the outbreak of World War I, Western civilization enjoyed an unprecedented century of peace, prosperity, development, and culture. Can it only be a coincidence at this very time that the Viennese waltz reached the apex of its popularity and form? Ed Fulner is an original member of the committee. I think he may have thought of resigning when, in the mid-1980s, the Washington Post actually published an article about us in which I said, when they asked, why are you doing this, I said, we waltz for peace. I didn't think I had to wink, but they played it straight. As a consequence of which, I got a letter from a senator on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee who said, my wife is making me write this letter. How can we become part of your great work? Now, our 25th anniversary of the committee approaches for the ball next February. Ed, you have to come back. As you note, due to the current condition of the world, there are two possibilities. Either we're not waltzing enough, or this organization was formed on a false premise. I'm not willing to admit the latter. So I'm speaking as a semi-private or a 501c3 individual here today. Well, there goes the first 3 minutes. Now, I'll start on this idea of the war of ideas by saying there are three cardinal rules. One, know yourself, know your enemy, and know your audience. And it's important not to confuse these three, or you may become your own worst enemy and end up talking to yourself. There are other fundamental maxims for the successful conduct of the war of ideas. In order to fight a war of ideas, one has to have an idea. This is not as simple as it may sound. A war of ideas is a struggle over the very nature of reality for which people are willing to die. Therefore, the first thing one must do is to formulate the ideas which are so central to one's life that one is not willing to live without them. Second, one cannot go into the war of ideas until one understands the ideas one is at war with. Such wars are always conducted in terms of moral legitimacy. The defense of one's ideas and the attack on those of the enemy are conducted with moral rhetoric. Axis of evil is a perfect example, as is the great Satan. Or I remind you of bin Laden's remark soon after 9/11, quote, our terrorism against America is commendable. It seeks to make the unjust stop making injustice, unquote. All the moral differences reflected in this rhetoric are at root theological. Third, wars of ideas, by definition, can only be fought by and with people who think. This defines the natural target audience for this war, the so-called elites. The term elite is not determined by social or economic status, but by intellectual capabilities. Trying to use ideas to influence people who do not think is an exercise in futility. Such people are led and influenced by people who do think. Now, this may seem so elementary to you as to be ridiculous, but I'm going to make it a little real for you. I think there, by the way, should be a Hippocratic oath for those who practice public diplomacy and participate in the war of ideas. And it should be, first, do no harm. So the first thing you should do is stop doing the things that are harming your side in the war of ideas. And I have to say, I was very encouraged when Karen Hughes undertook her responsibilities as the new Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy. One of her first actions was to suspend the State Department publication called HI International. HI International is aimed at Arabic youth, a key target audience. 1 year ago, in the April edition of HI, we have an article that begins, "Real men moisturize." In fact, some of them, like Michael Gustman, even have separate moisturizers for the face and body. Facial pores can clog with too heavy a salve, it seems. Gustman exfoliates. He gets manicures, he gets pedicures, he gets facials. He has his hair done every 2 weeks. He accessorizes, etc. This label has nothing to do with sex or sexual orientation. It has everything to do with aesthetic orientation. Metrosexuals are typically, and so this goes on. So she stopped that. So stop. Now, I had the experience of a discussion about the Cold War and the War of Ideas with the chairman of the Broadcasting Board of Governors from the Clinton era. And he told me that MTV won the Cold War. Not John Paul II, not Alexander Solzhenitsyn, not Ronald Reagan, not Václav Havel, not Lech Walesa. MTV won the Cold War. Now, reflecting upon the effect that our popular culture has around the world, and particularly in the Arab and Muslim world, mentioned by our prior speaker, the reaction of the audience is that the U.S. is consciously attempting to subvert the morals of Arab youth through this kind of music. As one Islamic scholar put it, American pop exemplars are, quote, torchbearers of American society with their cultural and social values. That are destroying humanity. They are ruining the lives of thousands of Muslims and leading them to destruction, away from their religion, ethics, and morality, unquote. Curiously, when American journalist Charles Glass was kidnapped as long ago as 1987 by Hezbollah, he reported that his young captors liked Michael Jackson and Madonna. So apparently MTV and terrorism are not necessarily incompatible. Abdullah Schleffer, who is actually a convert to Islam and runs the Adam Center for TV Journalism at American University in Cairo, said in 2003, he noted MTV, quote, which may get to their kids, appalls them, the Muslims. This is one of the weird things to hear the U.S. administration, which rests on a silent majority of churchgoers, talking about American culture in its Hollywood and New York television manifestations, which is utterly devoted to undermining the values of a conservative Christian society, unquote. Well, hey, if it can destroy Christian civilization, maybe it can destroy Muslim civilization. So it's sort of a shared anti-values campaign. And we wonder why they hate us. The crisis within the Islamic world, and most especially in the Muslim communities in Europe, is a moral one that can be defined in the options of personal submission to a greater purpose or greater freedom with no purpose. A very prescient Pakistani immigrant novelist in Great Britain published a novel, this was actually before 9/11, in which a Pakistani immigrant first generation father says to his son in Great Britain, I don't get it, why you don't like this? This is the greatest country in the world. I mean, they let you do anything here. The second generation son replies, I know. That's the problem. The loss of moral purpose in the vision of freedom that we're offering them hurts us badly. Number four, along with consistency of purpose, one must have the organizational and financial means for conducting a war of idea over the course of generations. Ideas, when they are profound enough to form the basis of a civilization, have a prolonged gestational period. I met K.P.S. Gill, who is one of the most, he's a Sikh gentleman from India, he's one of the foremost experts on counterterrorism. And he said to me, you have to realize in Kashmir that for a period of two decades, there was no terrorism. But during this period of 20 years, in the madrasas, they were inculcating the ideology of terrorism, and after that 20 years, the war of ideas was already over. They had won it. They had formed their cadre, and then the terrorism began. He said, you Americans think you have a three-month plan, a six-month plan, and maybe if strategic thinking is a one-year plan. You have to start thinking in terms of decades, and you need the institutional platforms from which to do that. Now, the United States is currently bereft of such institutions. It was referred to earlier here by Mac or somebody that the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, earlier this week in a remark at Carlisle Barracks, Pennsylvania, he was asked about the War of Ideas, and he said, well, I would give the United States D. Then through grade inflation, he said maybe a D plus. I think D is more accurate. And then he referred to his experience in the government as a congressman when the U.S. Information Agency still existed. The USIA was the institution responsible for the conduct of the War of Ideas during the Cold War. I'm an alumnus of that organization. Ed Fulner was the chairman of the Public Diplomacy Commission. Midge Dechter served on the Senior Ideas Committee for the director at that time. John Howard undertook programs for the U.S. Information Agency when the United States was trying to deploy cruise missiles and Pershing IIs in Western Europe by gathering theologians and clergy from here to go talk to their confreres in Europe about just war theory and the morality of nuclear weapons. There was an organization responsible for the conduct of this war. Now, if we're losing the war of ideas, the president, there's no, whom does he call? Not the state. The State Department's job is diplomacy, not public diplomacy. The two are in tension, and they will inevitably choose their first mission, which is that diplomacy. Now, we shouldn't be too surprised by a war of ideas. This country was born of a war of ideas. The first public diplomacy document of the United States was the Declaration of Independence, in which the principles were laid out, which we said were universal, meaning they were true everywhere at all times for everyone. And they also published this interesting document out of a decent respect for the opinions of mankind. Well, why would mankind care what 13 little colonies on the northeastern seaboard were doing? Precisely because they thought what they were claiming was of universal significance. And so it has proved in the past several centuries. What has changed are not so much our ideas, except to the extent to which we have become degenerate and no longer adhere to them ourselves. What has changed in character is the enemy that we're facing, each of whom has denied the central premise in that document in one way or the other that all people are created equal. Whether it was the Nazi ideologues who said only Aryans are created equal and we need to kill the Jews and enslave the Slavs, or the communists who said only the bourgeoisie is created equal and we need to kill the kulaks and the bourgeoisie, I mean the proletariat is created equal. And now we are faced with a new totalitarianism, which also dehumanizes a large part of mankind through its transmogrification of Islam. And I will tell you, as a foot soldier in the Cold War, as a student of Gerhard Niemeyer, who looked so closely at the nature of 20th century ideology, that you can go feature by feature through radical Islam or Islamism and find the exact same thing. The denigration of reason, the primacy of force, the necessity of force to achieve the transformation of reality, through this second reality that Barry Cooper talks about and has written so brilliantly about in his book, the absence and denigration of free will. The only big difference is they are not secularists. They base this on a deformed theology of God as pure will. And this deformed theology has produced a spiritual pathology and a dysfunctional culture. How dysfunctional is really hard for you to grasp or for us to grasp unless we, you know, examine some of the symptoms, most particularly in the Arab world. My wife is Spanish. That country produces more GDP than the entire Arab world, 300 million people. Spain in 1 year translates more books than the Arab world has translated in 1,000 years. We can go on with the symptoms of the dysfunction, but the problem is that this inner collapse of the civilization has created a tremendous crisis for us. And the danger is the crisis is going to be interpreted for the Islamists to radicalize the entire Muslim world with their crazy dreams of the caliphate, nuclear weapons, and oil that can put them in a position to do this. There's no reason why we need to concede this ground to them. We have ideas that are more than morally defensible. They happen to be true. And we can also engage the moderate Muslims who've been referred to here multiple times by actually helping them, by keeping them alive, and by getting them the resources they need to be heard inside the Muslim world. That may require us to do that at two or three steps removed because they'll be contaminated with direct contact with us. I'm just going to try to wrap up here by saying that the United States is conspicuous in its absence from the war of ideas. If the U.S. sent its troops into battle without armor or ammunition, there would be a political outcry, as there was when that was thought to be the case in Iraq. Such negligence would be deadly. If our soldiers are willing to die, we ought to be able to explain to others what they're dying for. It's the least we owe them, I think. Our failure to do so has not provoked a similar outcry. Now, the only possible reason for failure is that we do not have a consensus in this country over what it represents. That we're so confused over the essential issues concerning the meanings of life, family, and moral worth that we cannot coherently articulate a set of ideas to project. Some of the debates in the world of academe, politics, and media make this explanation unfortunately plausible, but not finally persuasive. Threats to national existence have a marvelous way of concentrating the mind on exactly why we do have a moral right to exist, in fact, an imperative to exist in a certain way. President Bush articulates this well enough in the space of a short speech, but he's only the tip of the spear. Where's the rest of the spear? This is a long struggle, ladies and gentlemen, just as was the Cold War. How will we know when we have won? What are the metrics? You know, the metrics don't do anything unless you can measure the result. If you try to measure it, you're going to miss it in this war. In 1982, as was referred to here earlier today, Ronald Reagan, without any public polling, because none was possible in the Soviet Union or Eastern Europe at that time, made a political judgment. And he referred to the Soviet Union as an evil empire. Only later did we learn how profoundly that remark shook that empire at its foundations. 8 years later, Alexander Yakovlev, the ideology chief of the Politburo, whom Midge Decker and I met in Moscow once, made a statement that I faxed all around Washington in 1990. He said, "I have come to realize that Leninism, based upon class struggle and class hatred, is evil," unquote. The man in charge of defending and promoting Leninism just said it was evil. He just agreed with Ronald Reagan. That's how we know we won. Our enemy's vocabulary changed into our own. Now, we aspire to a similar victory over the new totalitarians. But in order to do it, we have to get our moral rhetoric lined up, our resources, and conduct some kind of coherent war in that respect. Thanks so much.